Good morning, everyone. So there's a small group that meets about once a month. It's a group of students who I have either ordained or are lay teacher in training or are kind of on that path. And recently we started studying together from the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of koans that's pretty famous in the Buddhist world. And we had a really great discussion about a week ago. And so I thought I wanted to share some of what we talked about. What I would like to talk about is the case one of the Blue Cliff Record, which has the title of The Highest Meaning of the Holy Truths. And this is a very famous story, so people who have been around for a while have probably heard it at least once, if not multiple times. But if you haven't heard it, then it's probably good that you do hear it. So, and hopefully those of you who have heard it already will still find something there. So one of the main characters in this story is Bodhidharma. Here's a rendering of him. And I've also got him up here on the altar. And maybe we can just pass this around if people want to see it close up. So koans are teaching stories, and sometimes they have references that to us are obscure. And sometimes, even at the time, the way that the language was used might have been a little bit obscure because they're trying to point at something which can't really be described in words. So I'll just say that first. I can't really stop you from being annoyed or frustrated if that comes up for you when I read this, but I want to just give a warning. So I'm gonna read the main case and then we'll talk about it. Each of these have like an introduction, the main part of the story, and then a verse at the end. But I'm going to start with just the main case. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma said, "Empty, without holiness." The emperor said, "Who is facing me?" Bodhidharma replied, "I don't know." The emperor did not understand. After this, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the Kingdom of Wei. Later, the emperor brought this up to Master Qi and asked him about it. Master Qi said, "Does your majesty know who this man is?" The emperor said, "I don't know." Master Qi said, "He is Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, transmitting the Buddha mind seal." The emperor felt regretful, so he wanted to send an emissary to go get Bodhidharma to return. Master Qi told him, "Your Majesty, don't send someone to fetch him back. Even if everyone in the whole country went to go after him, he still wouldn't return." So that's the story. So I'm going to back up a little bit and say a little bit about what is this collection that I'm reading from. What is the Blue Cliff Record? So this is a collection of 100 teaching stories. It was compiled by Zhuo Do, who lived from the years 980 to 1052 in the Common Era. And he compiled them, and he also wrote a verse for each one. So like there's a story that's been passed down of old, and then here's a poem that I wrote about it. And these stories that he compiled were very old. Some of the events that happened and the stories that he was compiling were like 600 years prior to his writing them down. So now, for us, these stories are about 1,700 years old. So we might wonder, why are we still studying them? I think the reason is, and the reason that they continue to be studied and told, is that the teachings that are contained in these stories are still true. Sometimes, as I said, the references and the metaphors might be obscure to us, but the stories can still, I believe, have relevance for our lives. And really, if you don't understand this koan, that's okay, because really you only need to practice the koan of your life. What am I doing here? Who am I? Why am I here? So there's a preface to the Blue Cliff Record, and in it, it tells the story of two kings who are going to make a trade. One king owned a priceless jewel, and he was going to trade it to the other king in exchange for 15 cities. The first king sent an emissary with the jewel to the second king. The second king looked at the jewel, and at the last minute, he had cold feet. And he thought, oh no, I don't really want to give up the 15 cities. The emissary threatened to take the jewel and smash it into a million bits. And finally, the king relented and held up his end of the bargain. So it says in the preface, unless we are willing to give up our attachments, let go of those 15 cities, we cannot appreciate the priceless jewel of our true nature. Each case of the Blue Cliff Record shows us not only where to find the jewel, but also how to dig it out and cut it and polish it to bring out its inherent beauty and magnificence. So that's sort of like an advertisement for the Blue Cliff Record. You may or may not find that to be true, but we'll see. I think it's really fortunate that Xue Do compiled these 100 stories. And I want to say a little bit, too, about who was this Xue Do. So he was a Chinese monk. He was three generations after Yun Men, who's a famous Zen teacher, and eight generations after Shi Tao, who was the author of The Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, which some of you know, and also The Harmony of Difference and Sameness, which we sometimes chant here. We chanted it earlier this morning. So Shi Tao is in our lineage, but Yun Men and Xue Do are not. Well, there is a Xue Do in our lineage, but it's not the Xue Do who wrote the Blue Cliff Record. And actually, the lineage of Yun Men and Xue Do died out when looked at in the conventional way. In other words, no direct Dharma heirs of Yun Men or Xue Do exist today. So there's a big emphasis in Zen Buddhism, in Buddhism also, of mind-to-mind transmission or teacher to student. So it's like the Dharma is transmitted from teacher to student, and then that student becomes a teacher who transmits it to the next student, and so on. And so sometimes you have these lines where there is a student, it becomes a teacher, and then they don't have any students who continue the line like that. They don't continue the direct line, but of course, in a way, their direct line still exists, because here we are learning from them even today, all these years later. So we're keeping the whole lineage alive. So about 60 years after Xue Do's death, Yuan Wu, who is in the Rinzai line of Zen, so kind of like our cousin. We're Soto Zen, and Rinzai is kind of a cousin. He wrote pointers and commentaries. So pointers are like introductions to help us understand the story, and then a commentary to help us further understand. And also he wrote a commentary on Xue Do's verse. And when he did that, he was living at Blue Cliff Hermitage. So that's how this came to be known as the Blue Cliff Record. There's also a legend that Dai Gui, who was a famous monk after Zhuido, tried to have the Blue Cliff record destroyed. So he saw that it was becoming very popular and actually becoming harmful because people were just parroting the words instead of looking deeply into their true nature, into each person's Buddha nature. They weren't looking within anymore. They were just parroting the words. So he destroyed the printed book, and he tried to get a hold of the wood blocks and burn them too. But somehow a contraband copy survived. So we do have the Blue Cliff record today. So I'd like to start now with the pointer, which I didn't read yet. I'll read the whole pointer and then I'll talk about it. When you see smoke on the other side of the mountain, you already know there's a fire. When you see horns on the other side of a fence, right away you know there's an ox there. To understand three when one is raised, to judge precisely at a glance, this is the everyday food and drink of a patch-robed monk. Getting to where she cuts off myriad streams, by the way, this is Norman Fisher's interpretation. In the original, it's he. He changed it to she, just so that we know it can be a he or a she, or they. Getting to where she cuts off the myriad streams, she is free to arise in the east and sink in the west, to go against or to go with in any and all directions, free to give or take away. But say, at just such a time, whose actions are these? Look into Zhuido's trailing vines. Okay, just a true confession. When I first started studying Buddhism, I used to really hate this stuff. I really hated it. I thought this is just like using language in a way that's only meant to, it doesn't really mean anything. I still sort of have that a little bit, it sort of resonates a little bit when I read these, but having studied them a little bit, now I can sometimes see what's being pointed at. And that's what I hope to be able to share. So there's this beginning part. When you see smoke, you know there's a fire. When you see horns, there's an ox. All right, that seems pretty simple, right? It's making an inference or extrapolating from incomplete data. Okay, we can kind of figure that out. Also, understanding three when one is raised. Well, I looked up what that might mean. There's a few different things. So that's a reference that we might not know. From Confucius, there's a line. And so, of course, Confucianism would have been present in China. You know, so this would have been something familiar to the teachers who were telling these stories. Anyway, there's a line, I do not open up the truth to one who is not eager to get knowledge, nor help out anyone who is not anxious to explain himself. When I have presented one corner of a subject to anyone, and he cannot from it learn the other three, I do not repeat my lesson. So that's like this, like there's one corner so of this piece of paper or a book and say, okay, here it is, I'm going to talk about this. And then you should understand that there's three other corners. That's what that's about. So it's like if you're really kind of paying attention and really wanting to learn, you'll be willing to kind of go that extra step. So that's what that reference probably is. But there's another potential reference, which when we were studying this together in this study group, one of my students shared with me. So she's studied a little bit of the I Ching. And she said, in the I Ching, when you make a line, like a one, then you're raising a form, like you're saying something is here. This has a name and a form. So that could be whether that's a person, whether that's a flower, whether that's a tree. You're establishing something is here. And there's kind of the next stroke that follows, the two, is a negation. So if you've raised the something is here, then the possibility of something not being here also is present. So I think about that with these flowers, like on the altar. So there's a flower here, And that means that eventually there will be no flower because of impermanence. So this will die and, you know, it will be taken away probably before it's completely gone, but eventually it will be completely gone and there will be no flower. So the idea that once you say there's something here, then already there's the no thing, there's the negation. And then what follows next is three. And three is both the thing and its negation at the same time. And so that is, I would say, that is emptiness as we understand it in Buddhism. So not nothingness, it's not the negation, it's about form and emptiness. So we can say that original stroke, that one calling out the one thing, that cannot exist except in emptiness. So even just from a, let's use this as an example. We are here in this room, all of us, and we couldn't really be in this room if there weren't space. There weren't an empty space here for us to be in. So that's a kind of a way to understand it. So this understanding three, when one is raised, can be understanding form and emptiness, understanding the harmony of difference and sameness, or awakening to the whole works when form is raised. So the pointer continues. Getting to where she cuts off the myriad streams, she is free to arise in the east and sink in the west, to go against or to go with in any and all directions, free to give or take away. So to cut off the myriad streams is to let go of all our concerns. When we do that, we are free, we are liberated. We can rise in the east and sink in the west. So that's like the sun, just following the natural course of things, the natural order of things. Or we can go against, like attending a protest, standing up against racism and the system of white supremacy, speaking out against abuses of power in their many forms. But whether we are going with or going against, going in any and all directions, we are free. So usually we don't think of it like that. When we're going against, especially, it usually doesn't feel like we're free. But when we really let go, then we are free. We are liberated because we abide in emptiness that is not separate from form. But usually we don't live like that. It's difficult to drop all our worries. And there are so many things to worry about. So many things to keep us awake at night. There are many things that don't seem right in our personal life and in the world. And we want to do something. We should do something. But how can we let go of attaching to how it turns out? How can we do something and let go of attaching to how it turns out? How can we not stop the doing, but stop the worrying about it? The next lines of the pointer give us a clue. But say, at just such a time, whose actions are these? This question, whose actions are these, reminds us to consider, who am I really? Am I clinging to a separate sense of self? Am I forgetting that I'm connected with all beings? So you notice I didn't actually say the question of, am I a separate self? Because in a way we are. Like who we are individually is important. We can't throw that away. But we want to let go of the clinging part. We want to let go of the part that forgets that this individual self is actually profoundly and strongly interconnected with all things. So that's the pointer, sort of pointing us, okay, now that we have that, those ideas, now we go to the main case of the koan. But actually, before we do, I want to just say a little bit about Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu. So the kids in the youth program, they're studying about Bodhidharma. They probably aren't, they're not doing this koan. They're hearing more of the stories of Bodhidharma, which unfortunately I don't have time to tell all the stories, and they're great because he's legendary. So he's considered the first Chinese ancestor. He came from India and brought Buddhism to China. Well, Buddhism was already in China, but he's the one, like his lineage survived. The other lineages that were there did not survive. So he lived in the early 400s to about 530. You know, there's sort of a legend too. It's a little bit unclear like when he really lived and how long he lived. Sometimes people can live a long time though, so maybe. So when Bodhidharma, or when Buddhism, and especially Bodhidharma, came from India to China, Buddhism kind of mingled with Taoism, and that became Zen, or Chan in China, and then when it went to Japan, it was called Zen. So you could say in some ways that Bodhidharma is the first Zen ancestor. So he was born an Indian prince. I think he was the fourth son. And the king, his father, brought Prajnatara, a renowned Buddhist teacher, into court to teach his sons. Maybe his daughters too, let's hope so. Because actually Prajnatara was a woman, which is really a cool thing that scholars have sort of recently uncovered. So before that, we thought we were chanting the list of, when we were chanting the lineage, they were sometimes called the patriarchs. But now we can't say that. We have to say ancestors. So anyway, Bodhidharma was Prajnatara's best student. And eventually, after she had mind-to-mind transmission with him, said, okay, now you can go and teach. She said, I want you to go and teach in China. And it said that she could see that Buddhism was kind of dying out in India, and she didn't want it to die out altogether. So that's why she said, well, go to China. It's growing there, so it won't die out in the world. So Bodhidharma was known to be a very intense and severe teacher. You can see if that picture got around to you, you know, with the bug eyes, and, you know, often he's shown like frowning, and anyway, just very, very intense. He was really all about doing the practice, not reading about it. So in a way, it's funny that we're like telling these stories and it's like, well, get out there and do it. So I'm hoping that by this story, we'll motivate you to get out there and do it. One of the teachings that he's famous for is this four-line verse. A special transmission outside the scriptures, not depending on words and letters, directly pointing to the mind, seeing into one's true nature and attaining Buddhahood. So there's that guy. So soon after arriving in China, he is summoned to the court of Emperor Wu. Now, Emperor Wu was a person who actually, he attained power through murder and intrigue, so he was like, there was a lot of partisan politics, you might say, going on, and he seized power, really. And even though the guy before him was worse, okay, still. But then he became Buddhist. He started practicing Buddhism, and he was very serious about practice. And also, he kind of felt like as an atonement for his past sins, he did a lot to really help Buddhism thrive. So he built temples and he supported clergy. He also championed the idea that householders could also be ordained. So that was a little bit new, and received what he called the home-abiding, home-leaving bodhisattva precepts. So prior to that, it was really only the home leavers or the monastics who could be ordained. But he thought, well, lay people should be able to be ordained too. And then it's like, well, then I should be ordained, he thought. So then he was. So then, you know, well, anyway, he was not a perfect person. And so the case that I already read left out the very first part of their conversation, so I want to read that. So actually, the first question that Emperor Wu asked Bodhidharma, he said, I have built temples and ordained monks. What merit is there in this? Bodhidharma said, there is no merit. It's maybe not what he was hoping to hear. Then the case goes on. Emperor Wu asked Bodhidharma, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? Bodhidharma said, empty, no holy. The emperor said, who is facing me? Bodhidharma replied, I don't know. The emperor did not understand. A lot of times when I would read this, it's like, yeah, I can see why he didn't understand what's going on. So I decided that rather than like go through line by line and say what I think this each thing means, I want to take a different tact, which is I'd like for us to imagine that we are Emperor Wu and we meet Bodhidharma, this great teacher. And maybe our conversation would go a little bit differently. Our questions would be a little bit different. So here's my reinterpretation of this conversation. So here's Wu as you. Is what I'm doing with my life worthwhile? Is there any merit to it? Bodhidharma says, there is no merit. There is no measuring. And then you say, but what about the truth of the relative and absolute? I mean, according to the relative truth, I should understand what I'm doing and assess if it's the right thing. If I can do something positive in the world, shouldn't I do that? In the relative truth, there is merit in doing things such as developing compassion or building temples. And the absolute truth is not separate from the relative. We're taught that. So what is the deepest meaning of the teaching of relative and absolute? Bodhidharma says, empty, no holy. There is no high or low, no deep or shallow. It's all here. It's all empty of inherent nature. It's empty of separate nature. And then you say, okay, who are you really? Are you someone who can help me? Bodhidharma says, I don't know who this is. I don't experience a separate, unchanging self. And I can't help you. I can't wake up for you. And then you say, I don't understand. So it's said that after this exchange, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the Kingdom of Wei. So he went to where Shaolin Monastery is now, and he sat in a cave facing a wall for 9 years, so doing meditation for 9 years. So why did he do that? So one story is that they didn't allow him in the monastery. He was kind of a barbarian. I mean, he was like bug-eyed and, you know, and severe. And also, he was a foreigner, so they were a little, you know, suspicious of him. So that's one story. They didn't let him in, so he said, okay, face the wall. Well, they didn't let him in. He could have just gone somewhere else. So why did he decide to go into a cave? Well, maybe he was just doing the next thing. Like, okay, the audience with the emperor is over. Time to sit zazen. Why don't I do a sesshin for 9 years? But he may have been disappointed and discouraged. Like, I've come all this way. It's a perilous journey from India to China in those days. And I get to meet with the emperor, and then he doesn't understand what I'm saying. Or he may have thought, okay, the emperor didn't understand what I was saying. I better practice more. I'm not a very good teacher if I wasn't able to transmit this. So I better practice more till I become a better teacher. Or he might have felt that, well, the time is not right just now for China to receive this teaching. So I'll just go hang out for a while and wait until the conditions are right. So then there's the second part of the case where later the emperor brings up the matter to Master Qi and asks him about it. And then Master Qi says, "Does your majesty know who this man is?" "No." "Well, he knew he was a teacher, a Buddhist teacher, but no, I didn't really know who he was. That's why I asked him, who is this facing me? I didn't know who he was." And then Master Qi says, "He's Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal." When Norman Fisher wrote this out, he said, "Transmitting the Buddha mind seal to you." He was transmitting it to you. And the emperor felt regretful, and he wanted to send the emissary to go get Bodhidharma to return, but then Master Qi says, "No, don't. He's not going to come back. He's gone." In the commentary, Yuan Wu recounts that Emperor Wu regretted his failed encounter with Bodhidharma for the rest of his life. And after Bodhidharma's death, Emperor Wu wrote an inscription for the monument which read, "Alas, I saw him without seeing him. I met him without meeting him. I encountered him without encountering him. Now as before, I regret this deeply." So to that, Yuan Wu adds, "Tell me, where is Bodhidharma right now? You've stumbled past him without even realizing it." So he's living in regret and forgets that we're all connected, and actually the teaching of Bodhidharma is here right now, so he is here right now. But it's a good question to ask, where is Bodhidharma right now? Where is Bodhidharma right now? So sometimes as students, we get enamored of great teachers and we want them to come back. For example, I want Reverend Angel to come back. And I want Tenchin Roshi to come back. I want them to come back to Clouds and teach here. But I remember the last time Tenchin Roshi was here, he said something like, "I'm always practicing with you, but I had to come here so you would know that I'm always practicing with you." Most of the time we don't know that. So is there a separate self? Is there a separate self that's clung to? If not, then Tenshin Roshi is still here. Reverend Angel is still here. Bodhidharma is still here. And you are Buddha. You have everything you need to wake up and to be liberated. You don't need scriptures. You don't need something outside of yourself. So I'd like to close by just reading the last part of the verse, because we're running low on time here. So, I'll read the whole verse, but just talk about the last part. The whole verse is, "The holy truths are empty. How can you discern the point? Who is facing me?" Again, he said, "I don't know." Henceforth, he secretly crossed the river. How could he avoid the growth of a thicket of brambles? Though everyone in the whole country goes after him, he will not return. Wu goes on and on, vainly reflecting back. give up recollection. What limit is there to the pure wind circling the earth? Master Zhuedo looked around to the right and the left and said, "Is there any ancestor here?" He answered himself, "There is. Call them here to wash this old monk's feet." So remember, Zhuedo is the one who wrote this verse, and now he puts himself in it. He says, Master Zhuedo looked around to the right and left and said, "Is there any ancestor here?" And then he answered himself, "Yes." So, in other words, I'm here, so the ancestor is here. There's no separation. And then the last line, which also I have to thank Norman Fisher for this, call them here to wash this old monk's feet, instead of call him here. So there's a sense of the ancestor as a gender neutral, as a put in whatever gender makes sense for you, because actually the ancestor is you. So I thought, well, so maybe he's washing his own feet then, Zhuedo. Maybe he's saying, Bodhidharma, come and wash my feet, because there's no high and low, and a master can bow down. And anyway, the main point is that there's no separation, and that you are Buddha. And that's all I got. And we have just a few minutes, so probably time for one or two questions or comments. Yes?
Adley, my husband owns a karate school, and they also trace their lineage to Bodhidharma.
Yeah, it's interesting. I read recently that some of the scholars say that no, he probably didn't like start. Some people say, oh, he started Kung Fu. But other scholars say, no, he didn't. But who knows? I mean, it's a legend.
It's like Okinawan karate.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That could be. It's not really so odd, because at Shaolin Monastery, even today, they practice martial arts. So, yes.
How do you understand the threat to smash?
Yeah, that is so interesting. I don't really know. It seems a little bit like... So it's like Bodhidharma being the really stern teacher, like, come on, let go. If you don't let go, you won't even have your true shining nature. So it's really sort of pointing to the seriousness of the situation. But I also, since I'm kind of like scientific-minded, I thought, well, if you can smash that jewel, it's really not so precious, because the jewels are supposed to be really hard.
maybe it's just you've smashed your own jewel by holding it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like right? Yeah. It's good. Yes.
Oh, living in there,
yeah.
That maybe his, I don't know. Anyway, I thought all these, they're just making these transactions and it affects all these people.
Yeah.
So I was in a whole different place, like the jewel, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another way. That's a kind of maybe a more literal interpretation rather than metaphoric. But yeah, it does kind of, that metaphor does sort of have some problems. Yeah. So we could think of metaphors for us, like what are our 15 cities? You know, what is it that we're hanging on to that we feel like we can't give up? One more question or comment? Yes?
In Daigyo, Dogen comments on Master Chi saying that Bodhidharma is Avalokiteshvara,
mm-hmm.
by saying Master Chi doesn't know either.
Ah.
So what would it mean for Master Chi to be wrong?
Well, it's interesting because sometimes in these, Dogen says like everyone's right or everyone's wrong. So I don't, to me it doesn't matter if he's wrong. That he's wrong could be just to say, don't like get hung up on this. Because really, you are Avalokiteshvara. So for Master Chi to say to Emperor Wu, oh yeah, you missed this really great Avalokiteshvara. That was Avalokiteshvara. Instead of saying, well, actually, Emperor Wu, you are Avalokiteshvara. I don't know if that's what Dogen meant. What do you think?
I don't know.
Thank you. Yeah.
Do we know which came first, the Heart Sutra or Bodhidharma's thoughts?
I don't know that. Did anyone know that? Ken, do you know that? Seems like maybe those were like around the same time, perhaps. I don't know. Of course, the legend of the Heart Sutra is that it existed way before and then was just uncovered, but that's a legend, so probably that, who knows. Okay, I think we need to close to get ready for the kids, so thank you.